Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. For most of us, it's hard to think of anything less funny than cancer. The loss of hair, the loss of health, and sometimes life does not usually inspire humor. But our next guest has managed to find a way to the lighter side, but also the deeper human side of the question, and has helped other cancer survivors share their insights in a project called the Hairdo Monologues. Now she wants to take that project and package it in a way that will help inspire others who weren't able to join the fun last spring when the production, took place. Joining us now is Pat Wynn Brown, founder of Hair Theater and creator of the Hairdo Monologues, When Mansoor Chemo Styles Her Hair. Welcome back to the show, Pat.
Thank you, Anne. It's always good to be with you.
First, I want to tell people right off the bat that Pat has started a Kickstarter campaign. It's a link to it is on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. They're getting there and can use your help as well. So if you want to check that out, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Last time you were on, we were talking about the upcoming Hairdo Monologues, When Mansoor Chemo Styles Her Hair, which included a large cast of local people sharing their stories. Tell us just a little bit about that, Pat.
Well, we came together, and the good people at Ohio Health helped me to pull together patients and doctors and hair people. And my liaison there, Pauline Russ, was part of the cast, breast cancer survivor, but also she works in breast health at Ohio Health. And we had a workshop with the cast members. They wrote their monologues. We went into rehearsals. Everyone came to rehearsal. Everyone worked very hard. The doctors came. They did their monologues. They were on time. They were professional. And we put on a show, and you were there, Anne. In fact, you're in the little video on Kickstarter. You'll see Anne's smiling face there. And we put on a show for 400 people, and the reactions from that show were primarily this: you've got to get this out to people. And we had 40 people involved in this cast and crew and artists, performing artists from the community. But in order to get it out, Alan Beavers, the videographer who made our montage for the show of the workshop and the project, we started talking and we said, why don't we go on Kickstarter, see if we can get it publicly funded, make a DVD that breast cancer survivors or anyone facing hair loss from chemo can use, doctors can use, support groups can use it, and there's the show. And it'll be a little docu-concert. It won't be just the show.
Right.
It'll be how this came to be. And it'll be inspiring and entertaining and transforming. And I think you'll agree that that was a transforming experience that night in February.
Yes, I will. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guest is Pat Wynn Brown, founder of Hair Theater. She's been on the show many times. She's also the creator of the Hairdo Monologues, When Mansoor Chemo Styles Her Hair. We're talking about her Kickstarter campaign that's ongoing right now. If you want to check that out, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We're talking about how she's turning the Hairdo Monologues into a program for others, because obviously with a cast of 40, you spent almost a year working on this. You just don't whip it up and take it on the road, right, Pat? So even, you know, what always interested me about it was the process that you went through with the monologuists, and how that in and of itself was incredible therapy.
It was, and what we're going to do with that process, because we came together in our workshop, and none of the participants were actors, and we talked about hair, and we talked about hair loss, and how significant that is in the chemotherapy process. And often it's not addressed directly because, number one, the staff is working to make sure the patient is healthy, and hair may become secondary. But number two, a lot of times women don't discuss it with their doctors or even their nurses because they don't want to seem like they're vain. And it really is not a matter of vanity to feel bad about losing your hair. It's a matter of identity. And that's what the monologues brought up. And as you know, the monologues were poignant, endearing, but they were also funny and very, very entertaining. And my favorite comment after the show was from a woman who said, I came with a friend just to be supportive. I thought this night was going to be just maudlin and sad. She said, I don't have breast cancer, but I am changed by this experience. And I think everyone there felt the same way.
Let's listen to an excerpt from the show so people can know a little bit of what we're talking about. You'll be hearing Vicki Smith. She's an occupational therapist and breast cancer survivor. And she's describing how she and her husband, Tony Cochran, a creator of the Agnes comic strip, dealt with her pending hair loss.
Tony and I went wig shopping before I lost my hair. He took photos of me in wigs, and we joked about styles and colors, and I decided that however long it took my slow tide of hair to grow back, I would once again be a long-haired brunette. 2 years before my own diagnosis, I donated my hair for women with breast cancer. My good karma came back to me when Tony and I splurged on a human hair wig.
Pat, the process of buying a wig and decision to buy one is a big deal for people. You've talked about it before. It's kind of the basis of hair theater in general. What other topics came up?
Well, people talked about their hairdo histories, and that was one of the funny parts because in the workshop, I asked everybody to bring a significant hairdo photo from their past, and these photos are often hilarious because it might be a prom hairdo that went bad or wedding hair or a bang cutting before picture day at school. And people talked about their hairdo histories because when we tell our stories, I don't care what the story is about, but when we tell stories about our lives, there's a healing effect to that. And it's also very our lives are funny. The truth is hilarious. And I've been studying a little bit about narrative medicine, which is a new field. There are classes being offered at Columbia University to the medical students in that have the patient tell the story of their illness, and you're going to be able to diagnose the problem more correctly and treat it better. And it goes back to shamans. It goes back to the medicine men who would ask three questions. When did you stop dancing? When did you stop singing? And when did stories stop being enchanting to you? Because it has our road to recovery has a lot to do with keeping our spirits up, keeping our hope alive, and it helps us to stay in the battle. And I think that human spirit was the thing that I love most about the monologues. And then the artists reflected the message of the monologues in their art form, the singing and the Irish dancing and the drumming and the ukulele society and the ballet dancers dancing in the dark. That all went together into this beautiful picture of how stories and the arts and being heard, I think is the important thing, can truly make somebody feel better.
My guest is Pat Wynn Brown. We're talking about the hairdo monologues when Mansoor Chemo styles her hair. She is creating a program that other people can use. They don't have to be part of the monologues, but they can learn how to maybe do their own. It's a DVD she's creating, and she has a Kickstarter campaign ongoing now. If you want to learn more about that, you can check out the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you want to talk to Pat Wynn Brown, if you remember that show and want to give us a call, if you were a member of that show, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. Don't wait. We only have Patty for another 5 minutes. So make the call, 614-292-8513. Pat, of all the, you went into this, you spent almost a year from conception to execution. What surprised you about it? You know, you always go into a show with one thing on your mind, and you come out with something different. And we know that. We expect it's not going to be what you thought. But what surprised you?
What surprised me most but delighted me, really, was how professionally trained the cast members were by the time we got to the show. They truly did their homework. They worked on it. And when they got up there, this show was as good as anything you would see in Hollywood. They were so poised, and they were so funny, And I watched the audience from the wings, and I watched this little boy in the front. This little boy was riveted to everything everyone said, and the show was an hour and a half long. Mm-hmm. And at the very end, the standing ovation for the cast, which was well-deserved, and then the comment that happens every single time I do a show, and that is, I needed that laugh more than you'll ever know. I love the way that people have come forward to support the show. We have 71 backers right now for the Kickstarter campaign, and that campaign ends July 12th. And the important thing about that is you only receive any money if you reach your goal or exceed it. Otherwise, if you don't, you get nothing for it. So right now we're rolling with 15 days left, but we do need help to get to our goal.
Terry in Youngstown, you're on the air. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Ann. Pat, keep the good work. They always said humor is the best way of curing any illnesses. And when I went through that with my mom when she was dying of cancer, and we all knew she had 10 weeks to live. And some of the things that people would say, you know, like we don't want to come over because we don't want to give her anything that she can't, you know. And it's like, Mom, you're dying, you know. How can anyone else do anything harm, you know?
She's as sick as she's going to get. But, Terry, you are exactly right. And what I've noticed, too, with the people I visit, I've just visited my little friend Henry the other day, who's 18 years old with colon cancer. And I was really worried about visiting him. I didn't know him that well. I know his mother. And when I went, I kind of felt out the situation with his siblings and his dad there, and then we started laughing. And I reminded Henry, I said, you know, when I was re-diagnosed with my melanoma, I have to tell you I had to find a new surgeon because my oncology surgeon my age died, and I lived. And he thought that was very funny, that I outlived my oncology surgeon. God bless Dr. Walker. But, you know, even in that situation, an 18-year-old, wonderful, beautiful young man was able to laugh in the situation, and he started chemotherapy this week. So I wish Henry McCann well.
All right. Terry, thanks for your call. Take care. Pat Wynn Brown?
Yes, Ann.
Thanks for joining us today, squeezing us in on your busy schedule.
Oh, you know me. I'm just an aging showgirl with lots to do.
Well, thanks for joining us today and giving us a chance
Thank
to talk
you.
About the Kickstarter campaign for her hair monologues, When Mansoor Chemo Styles Her Hair. If you want to learn more about that, we got the link right on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. The deadline is July 12th. They're 70% there. Maybe by the end of the day, you're done, Patty.
Call us and call in and help us on Kickstarter. And thank you, Ann, and thank you, WOSU. You've been so kind to the show.
You're welcome. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We'll continue with Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series.
You're mobile, and we are too. 89.7 NPR News is now available anytime, anywhere, with the WOSU Public Media mobile app. Get your headlines on demand, listen to live streaming of 89.7, and your favorite podcasts like All Sides with Ann Fisher, Morning Edition, and All Things Considered. It's free and available for iPhone, iPad, and Android devices. Just go to WOSU.org/mobile app and download the app today.
Discover more about WOSU with the FYI e-newsletter. Get emails with program highlights and much more. Visit WOSU.org/email to sign up.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Spurred by recent debates over possible cuts to the food stamp or SNAP program, some members of Congress and their staffs have been shopping on a $31.50 food budget, the average weekly SNAP benefit. Many, mostly Democrats, complained that it was impossible to eat enough on so little money. One Republican staffer decided to challenge that notion. He said he managed to eat just fine for $27.98 in 1 week. He shared his grocery list to prove his point. The Washington Post wrote about it. We'll have a link to that story on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to check that out. I wanted to invite a nutritionist to assess those choices, though. Susan Levin is a director of nutrition education for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, and she joins us now from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we have the shopping list of Danny Ferguson. He's an aide to Republican Representative Steve Stockman. Danny spent just under $28 on this list. You have the list as well. It starts out with two boxes of honeycomb cereal, and he had me hooked right there. I had to go through the whole list. is just generally, I mean, I can recite the list very quickly. Two boxes of honeycomb cereal, three cans of red beans and rice, a jar of peanut butter, a bottle of grape jelly, a loaf of whole wheat bread, two cans of refried beans, a box of spaghetti, a large can of pasta sauce, 2 liters of root beer, a large box of popsicles, 24 servings of Weiler's fruit drink mix, 8 cups of applesauce, a bag of pinto beans, a bag of rice, a bag of cookies, 1 gallon of milk, a box of maple and brown sugar oatmeal. And I wanted you to assess that and just generally, what do you see there?
Well, you know, I'm going to keep my nutritionist hat on here and try to keep off my any kind of political hat. But what I see when I look at this list is something very economical. Like, yes, these are some good choices for keeping the bill low because he's eliminated apparently any meat products, which will help keep down the cost of foods. From there, though, he makes within that parameter, he still makes some poor choices and he makes some pretty good choices. I can see that he's buying beans, so he's getting a really good protein source from the refried beans and the red beans, and the pinto beans. And he's also choosing some whole grains, like the bag of rice, which is a very inexpensive way to get calories, is through dried grains. Same with the dried beans. He bought the dried pinto beans. Where he sort of goes wrong with some nutritional choices is spending money on drinks you don't need. All you really need to drink as an adult is water. So, you know, or past weaning, all you really need is water. So why waste your money on something as horrendous as root beer or fruit drink mix, milk? You don't need any of that. So that could have helped fund more fresh vegetables. I'm seeing a lack of fresh fruits and vegetables here, like maybe some spinach, which can be really inexpensive for people who use SNAP benefits, which is what all this is, you know, a commentary on. You can now, for a lot of people, use your SNAP benefits at farmers markets. Some places even have incentive programs where you get double the value of your SNAP at farmers markets when you buy fresh fruits and vegetables. So I'm seeing a little lack of creativity there. Spending money on pre-made oatmeal with this maple and brown sugar oatmeal, you could have just skipped the honeycombs and bought straight up rolled oats for really cheap and had a much more nutritious breakfast choice there. So I'm seeing some nitpicky things where he could have done better, but he certainly could have done worse.
Data have shown that proportion size potato chips cost almost twice as much as carrots. And you mentioned, you know, spinach is not expensive. Why do healthy foods have a reputation for being expensive this way?
Great question. And I tend to think it has to do with, you know, its popularity, and its popularity among people who have more disposable income has allowed companies like Whole Foods Market to come in and charge a heck of a lot of money to have all of these great choices in one place. And a lot of those prices, high prices, come from prepared and packaged healthful foods as opposed to just the fresh whole produce food, mm-hmm. which is always going to be a little less expensive. So I think there's just this market that, and people are willing to buy into it, literally pay a lot of money for packaged and prepared foods that they could do themselves at home with just the whole ingredients.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Susan Levin. She's Director of Nutrition Education for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. We're talking about, you know, how people can live healthfully on the average weekly amount of $28 a week in the SNAP program. If you have a question or comment for Susan Levin, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, cost isn't always a purely financial measure. Time is another enormous factor in food choices, particularly for people who need the kind of help that SNAP provides.
Mm-hmm.
Shopping
yeah.
takes time.
Shopping takes time and preparing food takes time. So when I mentioned that dried beans and dried grains.
That takes a long time.
Exactly. It's the cheapest and healthiest food choice you could probably make, but it's also, it requires time. You have, you know, depending on the bean, you have to soak the bean, you have to rinse the bean, you have to cook the bean for hours unless you have the right, you know, pressure cooker or crock pot. Not everybody has that. So we do recognize that there is a place for products like canned beans that just require reheating or just for, you know, or not. I mean, mm-hmm. oftentimes I open up a can of beans and don't bother reheating them. But, yeah, so there does need to be a place for foods that don't require any preparation because some people don't even have electricity who use SNAP benefits. So we try to keep that in mind as well.
And then there is the access issue. Fresh is great, but fresh is also more expensive, not just at Whole Foods, but at the inner city groceries. They don't have a lot of it, and it's not very good shape, mm-hmm. and it costs more.
Yeah, so here's an issue with the big picture to me. If we, and this is, you know, why we're even involved in discussing oftentimes SNAP benefits and how they could be improved. The organization where I work would like to see more restrictions on SNAP benefits, meaning you can't just buy anything that you want. And there's already some restrictions, of course. You can't buy tobacco or alcohol. But we'd like to see even more and more of an educational component there because most people who low-income populations have worse health outcomes than people who have access to health care and more income. So when they're eating poorly, and in this country, our chronic disease epidemics are 100% related to poor dietary choices or excessive dietary choices for nutrient-poor foods. We would like to see more education. We'd like to see some restrictions. So your SNAP benefits, if everyone was required to carry food, and believe you me, if SNAP benefits only apply to healthful foods, then all of these grocery stores, even those in food deserts, the bodegas would carry the mm-hmm. foods that we're talking about. It's a supply and demand issue.
You know, it should be noted, too, that SNAP benefits are not intended. They're a supplement. They're not intended to be the sole source of income for or money for food.
That's right. The S stands for supplemental nutrition. And we would like to see, yeah, more attention paid to that, but also to the nutrition aspect, too. This should be helping people live healthier lives, not hindering people's health. And even with that, though, even with the fact that the maximum amount of SNAP dollars for which a family, for which a an individual can qualify is $200 a month, so $50 a week.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done this math, too. Like, we've looked at the healthiest food options within reason, picking some canned and some frozen, some fresh, and then things like pasta and bread and peanut butter. And we've priced it out, and we have found that you can get a really healthful basket of groceries that will cover 1,800 calories a day. That's hardly supplemental. That's almost all most people need. But
mm-hmm.
but even then, if you make the right choices, you can get all the nutrients you need and help prevent chronic diseases like heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and cancer. So there's a really good way of going about this. It's a matter of bridging from where we are to that, to getting to that point.
Maria, I'm sorry. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I just wanted to mention that I happened to be at the North Market this morning thinking I would, you know, while I was in the neighborhood, grab a loaf of bread. It's a city market, and they don't accept food stamps.
It's North Market. Just for Susan's perspective, it's kind of like it's a city market. It's got a lot of different vendors under the same roof, that kind
mm-hmm.
of market.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And no one would accept them, or just the place you went to, Maria?
Well, I spoke to the woman. I was trying to get some bread at Omega.
Uh-huh.
And she's like, I'm sorry. First of all, she didn't know what I was handing her.
Mm-hmm.
And when I explained to her what it was, she was like, oh, I'm sorry, we don't accept that.
Okay.
And I said, around the market? And she said, that's what my boss told me.
Okay. All right. That's interesting. I don't think it's the case with everything at North Market, but Maria, thanks for calling.
Sure.
Take care. Another example of kind of an upscale sort of shopping experience
mm-hmm.
That can exclude. We are going to be, we have a live show, a remote show planned for the July 25th City Farmers Market, the City of Columbus's Health Department Farmers Market, and they certainly promote the use of SNAP coupons or SNAP cards and try to get people signed up for those kinds of things as well. So we'll have more information on that coming up. But if you want to put that on your calendar out there, we'll be at the City Farmers or the City of Columbus's Department of Health Farmers Market at the Health Department on Parsons Avenue on July 25th. David in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
There's a lot of effort now to get local food. Is there any effort to create more local community gardens that people could grow their own food that would supplement any other food? There's a lot of food thrown away, too, as mm-hmm. far as groceries. It doesn't stay fresh forever. So,
well, that would be a question for the Mid-Ohio Food Bank, in part, and to see what sort of help they get from groceries when it comes to fresh food. I know they're growing fresh food there, and there are community gardens, but I don't know to what extent, you know, the food is grown to help people out. I know there's a lot of churches that do that. They have their community gardens, and neighbors can drop by and grab what they need, but I'm certainly not an authority on it, and Susan's in Washington, so she's no good to us, David.
I think it would assist. You can grow a lot of food on a small plot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're just assuming that the only way to get food is to go to the store.
Well, when it comes to SNAP benefits, that is the assumption. That's what we're talking about today.
Right.
But
I mean, that's kind of, you know, mechanical thinking. I'd like to see more flexibility and then have people actually be able to help themselves a little more rather than just be dependent on a program. I think the more flexible the program is, and it should be adjusted to different localities, but the more options people have, the better they feel about themselves. And then also the more nutrition they can get.
Right. More fresh food.
Right.
All right, David, thank you. Take care. An email from Courtney. She said, politics aside, it concerns me that SNAP benefits do not account for lactose intolerance or a vegan lifestyle. Non-dairy milk is considerably more expensive than its counterpart, though the price is lowering. It would be great if SNAP benefits also explained good sources of inexpensive non-dairy calcium and vitamin D sources. So,
well, I agree with that. And I do think that, again, if you don't, if you're not an infant, then you don't really need to drink anything except water. So I tend to, even people who aren't on SNAP benefits, I try to steer them away from getting their calories through beverages anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I know programs like WIC, which is also a USDA program, as is SNAP, the Women, Infants, and Children program, they deal with lactose intolerance and those sort of issues by making soy milk available for people who use their WIC dollars. So that's good.
In the list from the Republican staffer in Washington, it included 8 cups of applesauce. And I was wondering, would it be better to get fresh apples?
Yes, it would be better nutritionally. There would be more fiber in the whole apple because you get the skin, whereas the applesauce has removed the skin and there's just a little bit of fiber. However, you know, it's not a bad, especially unsweetened applesauce. It's just mashed up apples. It's not a bad shelf-stable choice for people who maybe can't manage to eat, to consume all the fresh fruits and vegetables that they have. So I think, again, you could do a lot worse, and that's pretty good.
And apples are one example of a fruit that's getting pretty expensive right now.
It can be, and it's, you know, especially when they're not out of season or depending on where you live, mm-hmm. it can be a more expensive fruit. So I think a cup of applesauce, like I'm assuming when he says 8 cups, I'm picturing sort of those individual servings
right.
that can sit on your shelf for quite a long time. So I think that's actually pretty good. I have to praise the common sense behind buying that type of shelf-stable fruit source.
Then there was the jar of peanut butter and a bottle of grape jelly. You feel good about the peanut butter because of the protein?
Well, again, I think with something like peanut butter, especially for families who use SNAP, that's a pretty good choice for their kids to have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Kids like it. It's not going to have any cholesterol in it. It's going to be a decent source of protein. Again, with my nutrition hat on, I would hope that the whole wheat bread has a pretty good amount of fiber per slice, so it's not just white bread that's dyed brown with caramel color, which sometimes whole wheat bread can be. So I think, you know, I can get really nitpicky in there and, you know, choose the jelly that uses the 100% fruit as mm-hmm. opposed to the corn syrup. It's not that much more expensive. So there are definitely ways to make a peanut butter jelly sandwich pretty wholesome. And I would even suggest peanut butter and banana. So at least you're getting a whole fruit in that sandwich.
Once again, that's another fruit that can sit on the shelf for a week at least, a banana.
Yeah, and if you have, you know, a refrigeration source, it won't look pretty, but it's just as edible once you get the skin off if you refrigerate your bananas.
Okay, we got to take one more quick call. Hi, Beth in Clintonville. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I won't stay on too long. I just wanted to reply to the guy who said that he didn't know if there were enough accesses to fresh fruits and vegetables for people who are on SNAP. And that's actually somewhat of a misnomer. Wednesdays at the community pantry, the Clintonville Community Market Pantry, is Fresh Vegetable Day. Sometimes at the end of the day, they'll just get a bunch of produce from the grocery stores.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Local Matters has a veggie van, and that's open to anybody. You just have to call them or find out the information. You can probably find it out from the Clintonville resource.
Okay.
And then one other thing is that Local Matters really works hard on getting people access to local community gardens, starting community gardens, and I'm pretty sure there's one around Byland Park, and they're doing one with kids.
Okay.
They're doing it on the roof.
All right.
Godman Guild.
Okay, Godman Guild, right. They have a beautiful garden over there. Beth, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Okay,
so folks out there who have questions about things like that, you could start with the Clintonville Community Center or the pantry there, and maybe they'll have more ideas for you. Certainly the Columbus Department of Health has lots of ideas if you want to give them a call as well. Right now, I want to thank Susan Levin for joining us. Susan, thanks. You've been a lot of help.
Thank you so much.
Susan Levin is the Director of Nutrition Education for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Coming up, we'll continue Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from On the Square Yoga, offering 45-minute midday yoga classes at 11, noon, and 1 in downtown Columbus. On the Square Yoga, located at 65 East State Street between the Ohio Theater and the Sheraton, making yoga accessible to everybody. More at onthesquareyoga.com.
What's missing between Morning Edition and All Things Considered?
Could it be a comprehensive program of news, analysis, and features in the middle of your day?
That's it.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. And now NPR is combining resources with public radio stations all across the country for Here and Now.
Smart journalists taking you to places you've never been.
With stories that are significant, heartfelt, enlightening.
Starting Monday.
Here and Now.
Don't miss a thing.
Support comes from the Council for Older Adults of Delaware County, helping to provide compassionate in-home care for older loved ones. Its mission is to help older people live safely at home and avoid unnecessary institutional care. More at growingolder.org.
You can discover more about WOSU Public Media by signing up for our WOSU FYI e-newsletter. Once you sign up, you'll receive a biweekly arts and culture e-newsletter featuring program highlights from radio and television, special event information, ticket offers, and much more. Just visit wosu.org/email to sign up.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. These days, it seems like everybody who's anybody has a signature scent. Snooki, Derek Jeter, even universities have begun selling perfumes that capture the smell of their school. Think Mountain Air and Steel Pizza, I guess. But now, an even less probable but much more important smell has emerged. It's called melanoma, and it could be coming to a laboratory near you. Here to explain how on earth cancer has a smell is Dr. George Preti. He is a researcher at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. Welcome to the show, Dr. Preti.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
This research sounds amazing. You basically found that there's a way for very sensitive equipment to detect melanoma at an early stage by detecting a particular odor. So diseases have a scent. How did it occur to you to even look in this direction?
Okay, well, yes, it's been known since the time of Aristotle, all the writings of Aristotle and some of the old classical Roman physicians all talked about using odor as a diagnostic tool. I mean, if you think about it, they couldn't take a blood sample and send it off to Quest Diagnostics or some other clinical lab and look for, you know, a couple hundred different things in a blood sample. So they had to use their senses, all of their senses, in evaluating patients for different disorders. And they did come up with some very amazing correlations between odors being emanating from the different parts of the body and certain disease states. Now, the other thing you have to remember is that back in the time of Aristotle, diseases probably got to be a lot more advanced than physicians in modern Western cultures see them now. So, for example, Aristotle and others have described the smell of smallpox, but we don't see smallpox anymore. It's been wiped out, eradicated, except probably for some as a bioweapon. So there is a lot of writings on how different odors are associated with different diseases.
Go ahead.
And I'm not making a perfume out of melanoma, by the way, with regard to your
introduction. I'm going to just guess it probably doesn't smell very good. But.
Well, it's what we did was we grew cells, and there are cell lines that are available to researchers. And what we did was we grew the cell, different melanoma cell lines, and contrasted them to normal cell lines from normal skin, to look at the differences that are present. So that's called an in vitro experiment. That is we didn't sample living human beings, but we are actually doing that now. We are sampling melanoma sites in newly diagnosed cases, and trying to get a profile off of living human tissue. To present as a more accurate picture, perhaps, than the cell lines that we did already.
Why did you start with melanoma?
We actually started with basal cell carcinoma,
okay.
a much simpler and more widespread skin cancer. Mm-hmm. But melanoma is more deadly, and people are more, I think, a little more interested in this because there is a huge increase in the number of cases that are being reported. Particularly in the United States, in younger people, Australia, in different people there of a certain age are often getting more melanoma cases than previously. We don't know if it's because of increased UV exposure or people sitting out in the sun more, but for whatever the reason, there are more cases being reported in the last decade or so.
Melanoma, you're not talking about advanced cases of melanoma. You're trying to be able to detect these at a very early stage when, to the normal person, there is no odor.
No, correct. I mean, you always try for the earliest diagnosis possible because that helps. The earlier the diagnosis, the better the outcome is the rule of thumb that I've gotten mm-hmm. from my clinician friends. I'm not a physician. I'm a PhD in organic analytical chemistry, and I study human body odors.
And you're doing this in order to make this test useful in clinical settings. You've also tested a portable nanosensor. What's that?
Okay, nanosensors. That's my colleague, Dr. Charlie Johnson, who's in the Department of Physics and Astronomy here at the University of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And Charlie's lab is developing DNA-coated carbon nanotubes as very sensitive and specific vapor phase detectors. So these are, as you can imagine, a nanotube is very, very teeny. And I mean, you could fit hundreds of them or thousands of them on a space the size of your fingernail. The idea is that you could put many hundreds of these sensors in a small space, and they all can have a slightly different function. So they'll be able to detect different chemicals in the air at different concentrations and with different specificity, much the same as the olfactory sensors in your nose does. In your nose, you have olfactory receptors, as they're called, that interact with organic chemicals in the vapor phase, and they send a signal back to the brain to tell you that you're smelling something, a rose, a cup of coffee, peanut butter, whatever you're smelling.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that these... eventually, what we'd like to do is to put many of these sensors into what's called an electronic nose, so that you can pull air over onto them, and they'll give you a signal that's indicative of whatever you are smelling, be it melanoma or spoiled meat or a bacterial infection. So we have many planned medical uses for these very novel sensor devices.
Right, not just, but as far as the different kinds of cancers they could be used on, is the world our oyster on that score, or would it only work for certain kinds of cancers?
Well, oddly enough, we're letting our animal friends tell us which ones we could best go after.
Huh.
Dogs have been trained to detect a variety of different types of human cancers by the odor the cancer emits. So dogs can detect, breast carcinoma, melanoma. They've been trained to detect melanoma. And they apparently, in the study I've read, they do it as good or better than trained clinicians. They can detect urinary tract carcinomas and ovarian carcinoma, lung cancer also. So there's a whole variety of cancers that dogs can be trained to detect, which tells us that there is a volatile odor signature associated with each of these cancers that the dogs can pick up. So the question is, the dogs can be trained to do it. The dogs have very sensitive noses, and you know, dogs use their noses for everything. You know, for those of you who have a dog, you'll know what I'm talking about. They sniff everything. Yeah,
and with a big nose.
Right, and so they. If the dogs can do it, can we do it with our instrumentation? So that's what we are looking at right now. That's one of the avenues my lab is pursuing. My lab does what we call biomarker discovery. We look for the chemicals coming off the airborne chemicals coming off the cancer with our analytical instrumentation, and then we see if we can adapt those to these sensor devices that will eventually or hopefully be used in a clinical setting for analysis.
We've been talking about melanoma and how they're working on identifying it at a micro level using the sense. Melanoma accounts for 3/4 of skin cancer deaths, and detecting it early by scent perhaps can save lives. Here to tell us more about how to prevent it in the first place is Dr. David Carr. He's a professor of dermatology at Ohio State. Welcome, Dr. Carr.
Thank you.
Melanoma rates have been on the rise in the last 30 years, as Dr. Preddy mentioned. Why is that? I thought people were using a lot more sunblock than they used to.
Yeah, so we're looking at, there's a number of reasons why it might be increasing. One that people have certainly looked at is increased surveillance. So over the last 30 years, definitely with the American Academy of Dermatology, there's been an increased push towards having regular skin examinations. So the thought is that we're catching more of these instead of just sort of letting them go. The expectation would be, though, after about 30 years of having those programs in place, is that there would be a plateauing of the cases of melanoma, and we're not really seeing that. One of the other things that people are certainly looking at is something that was brought up previously, and that's with the increased use of or exposure to UV and the possible role of that with increasing melanoma rates.
You mean like tanning beds and that sort of thing?
Right. So tanning beds and just UV exposure in general.
Okay. Melanoma is treatable, isn't it?
So it is treatable, especially when we can catch it early, and that's really the key with melanoma. So if we catch melanoma early, where it's one basically an early stage, it's about 98% curable. As soon as it goes to the lymph nodes, we're talking about much lower rates, about 65% curable. And then if it's actually metastatic past there, we're down to between 5 and 15%. So really the key with melanoma is catching it when it's early.
Now, exposure to the sun, will sunblock help?
Right. So sunblock is certainly an interesting story and an evolving story. So with sunblock, there's a couple of very important things when we talk about it. And, you know, the first thing is the different types of rays. So there are UVA and UVB rays. And historically, when you used to look at that number, the SPF number on the sunblock bottle, that was only for UVB. And we know that B causes burns, and it's been shown to be a carcinogen. UVA ages the skin, and it's also been shown to be a carcinogen. And so historically, when you looked at the SPF, the UVA was not included. That was only showing you what was being blocked with UVB.
Mm-hmm.
In late 2012, the FDA really came behind that to be labeled as broad spectrum, you do need to have both UVA and UVB protection. So now you can be somewhat confident when you go to the store and see a label with broad spectrum that you're basically trying to block both of those UVA and UVB rays. Go ahead.
One development that's been credited for the increased use of sunblockers is the nanotechnology.
Right.
Making it creamier and it disappears on your skin and not like that white stuff on your nose that we grew up with. And supposedly we can have higher and higher levels of this protection, but what is higher is not necessarily better. Is there an ideal? Because now I'm seeing 100. I just went out to get some for my kid who's going to camp. I saw it in the hundreds.
Right. So there are two main points here for that question. The first one is, what does the SPF number mean? And the SPF number, it really is not 30 is twice as good as 15, 60 is twice as good as 30. When you're at 15, you're blocking about 93% of rays. By the time you're up to 30, you're at 97, and at 50, you're at 98. So it's really sort of a diminishing return. And really the recommendation from most dermatologists at this point is to have at least an SPF of 30. And above that, you're really not getting too much benefit. The other part of the question is sort of the nanotechnology. So there are two main types of sunscreen. There's physical blockers and chemical ones. So physical blockers are what you thought of in the past with the white noses on the lifeguards. So zinc oxide and titanium. And those two components can quite turn the skin opaque or white. And so nanotechnology has allowed us to be able to apply those sunscreens in a much more cosmetically appealing way and not turning the skin white.
Some medications recommend staying out of the sun if you're taking them. Could we increase our risk of melanoma by ignoring these warnings?
Certainly. So there are a couple of studies now. They're not particularly looking at melanoma. They're looking at non-melanoma skin cancer, such as basal cell and squamous cell, with certain medications. So there are medications that will increase your risk of getting burned in the sun. And you certainly need to follow the warnings for those medications, because if not, we do know that we're likely going to see an increased risk of skin cancer in those patients.
Does it help, I mean, when you're wearing clothes, do clothes adequately block the sun, or are there some now that maybe don't enough?
Right. So clothes do help to block the sun, but not completely. So it's one of those things where our general recommendation is, when you're going out in the sun, you need to be putting sunscreen on 15 minutes before you go out and every 2 hours afterwards, everywhere that's exposed. If you're very sensitive to the sun or have some type of photosensitive condition, that's when we get into, there are certain preparations that you can wash your clothes with and different fabrics that you can use that will help protect you from the sun further.
Now, you know, we're always supposed to be checking for ticks after we've gone for a hike. Should we also be checking for changes in our skin over time? What do you look for?
So, you know, it really, there's, again, this comes down to whether we're talking about melanoma or non-melanoma skin cancer. So with regards to melanoma, certainly we recommend at this point, you know, everyone should be looking at their skin about every month. And we break it down into an A, B, C, D, E to sort of help make it a little bit easier on people. And A is for asymmetry. So if a spot on your skin, one side doesn't look like the other, that's a bit of a warning sign. B is for border, so a nice regular border is what we're looking for. If it's fuzzy or blurry, that could be a warning sign. C is for color. We like to see one color within a spot. If you're getting more than one color or changing in color, that's something to look for. D is for diameter, about a pencil head eraser or 6 millimeters. We want lesions smaller than that. And E is for evolving. So basically on all those A, B, C, D, we want to see if it's changing. Mm-hmm. And if it's changing over time, that's certainly something that needs to be brought to the attention of a dermatologist. With regard to non-melanoma skin cancer, what we're really looking for are new spots that aren't healing within 3 to 4 weeks. So if you have a new inflammatory spot, that should be going away in about 3 to 4 weeks. If something is sticking around longer than that, it really should be evaluated.
All right. Well, Dr. David Carr, thanks so much for joining us and wrapping up this conversation about melanoma.
Thank you.
Dr. David Carr, dermatology professor at Ohio State, and also Dr. George Preddy, human odor researcher at Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. Thank you, doctor.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.